Anna, I wanted to tell you something.
What?
Well, pretty soon, maybe as soon as next week, they're going to have COVID shots for kids.
I'm very scared.
Oh, you are? Tell me why you're scared. What are you scared about?
Because I don't like shots.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're listening to a conversation I had with my 7-year-old this weekend. As the youngest in our family, Anna is the only unvaccinated person in our household. Coronavirus pandemic began while she was still just a kindergartner. Masks, social distance, canceled trips, and curtailed time with friends and family has characterized much of her childhood. But I wasn't sure how she was feeling, so we had some extended family conversations about this vaccine this weekend.
Would you like to have the vaccine?
Yeah.
Okay, so why would you like to have the vaccine?
So that COVID might go away one day.
What would be your favorite thing about coronavirus going away?
Being able to visit my friend's house a lot again.
So I gotta say, I was happy to hear that my kiddo didn't feel afraid of illness or sickness, but like many of us, she's hoping to get back to a little bit more normalcy. And it's a theme echoed by Dr. Janet Woodcock, the acting FDA commissioner, last week.
Now, as a mother and as a physician, I know parents, caregivers, school staff, and children have been waiting for today's authorization. Vaccinating younger children against COVID-19 will bring us closer to returning to a sense of normalcy.
So we're now just days away from the CDC's expected recommendation to authorize COVID-19 vaccines for kids ages 5 to 11 after studies showing 90% efficacy. Last week, the FDA approved the administration of the Pfizer vaccine for this age group, leaving it up to the CDC for final approval. And if the CDC gives this expected approval, 5 to 11-year-olds can be eligible for a shot by the end of this week. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation survey found that about 3 out of 10 parents say they'll be making a mad dash to the doctor's office with their children, while the rest may not be so eager. Even many parents who quickly secured vaccinations for themselves and their elders may have lingering questions. And there were plenty of questions in our house this weekend.
Are you feeling more scared of the shot or more scared about coronavirus?
Both.
Both.
Why do they have to do it with shots?
That's a great question, Anna. We'll ask that question, okay? I'm not sure. We'll have to ask.
So why does it have to be a shot? We begin today with this question and with the questions you and your family might have about the vaccine before you're ready to make an appointment with your pediatrician. Here with me now is Dr. Bhakti Hansoti, who is director of the Center for Global Emergency Care and associate professor of emergency medicine and international health at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Hansoti, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. What an exciting conversation.
I know, right? So can we start with Anna's question? Why is the vaccine delivered as a shot?
You know what? I don't think that's going to be the state constantly. I think we're going to get an oral or a spray version of the vaccine, just like the flu mist. But we're just not there yet right now. And this is the best way we know to get you exposed to the virus and start building an immune response.
All right. So the FDA has approved the Pfizer vaccine. So given that, does that mean that parents could go and get it right now? Or is it necessary to wait for that CDC recommendation?
So we'll need the CDC approval before health practices are able to distribute the vaccine and give it to your children. So November 2nd, tomorrow, is when the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices meets. And we think the CDC will give their approval within 24 hours of that meeting tomorrow. So it's happening. This weekend is a big one.
It is a big one. I kind of almost wish, you know, I'm just thinking about having handed out a lot of Halloween candy last night. And there was a little part of me that thought, sort of wish we'd had that 5 to 11 vaccine before, but so happy that it's finally here. But I'm wondering, where do we stand right now in terms of vaccination rates and spread of the virus?
So, you know, we're in a good place, right? So I think 67% of Americans have had their first shot, 58% have been fully immunized. Our COVID cases are low, as are our COVID hospitalization and deaths. We're in a good spot, but winter is coming. as they say, and people go indoors, people like to eat indoors, and there's increased opportunities for transmission. So this is a great time for us to get our children vaccinated.
So tell me why. Why does and how does vaccinating this age group, the 5 to 11-year-olds, how does it likely to affect the overall community spread?
So there are certain individuals in our community that are unable to mount an immune response, those that have underlying illness or on medications for treating those illnesses, such as cancer patients, individuals who have conditions such as HIV. And children are still able to transmit the virus. They may not get as severely ill, although some do get ill and some do die. They can still transmit the virus to other vulnerable populations. And so by vaccinating this group will hopefully decrease the amount of vaccine virus that is transmitted in the population.
All right. So it wasn't just my household where there were some questions. We know a lot of parents have questions. So we asked our takeaway community to send us some of those questions. We know that the American Academy of Pediatrics has cited findings talking about benefits outweighing the risks, but there are still some parents concerned about risk. Let's take a listen to Kathleen.
I've heard that children only have a low chance of getting COVID. Could you compare the risks of children getting COVID with the statistical risks of the side effects that they've talked about in kids such as myocarditis?
Absolutely. So the risk of myocarditis is far lower than the likelihood of your child getting COVID and being severely ill. In September alone in the United States, we had 40 children die of COVID and millions were affected. And so again, the risk of death and dying and having severe illness with COVID is low, but the risk of myocarditis is lower. Also, the numbers in the myocarditis vary depending on the type of vaccine and the specific age of the child. However, the other thing is that we know that while children with myocarditis are temporarily ill, many of them do recover, while those who are severely ill with COVID may have significant long-standing side effects.
Can you say just a few more words about that kind of long-term COVID? We know it's something we've talked a bit about here on the show with adults, but what does long-haul COVID look like in kids?
Well, I think there's a bit of a challenge here in characterizing long COVID. So let's start with what it looks like in adults. In adults, some individuals will have, for greater than 12 weeks, symptoms of persistently high heart rates, difficulty breathing, shortness of breath, and or neurological complications, either longstanding mental health complications, such as depression, or this phenomenon called COVID fog, right? This haziness that exists. In children, we have even less data. We have not been able to fully characterize COVID and make that case definition. So long COVID studies have, depending on their case definition, have said that up to 50%, up to half of children will have persistent symptoms after 120 days. And that in half of these patients, so 25% of the overall population, these can impact the activities of daily living. However, there was another recent large review that said that across 14 international studies with 20,000 patients, that they found that, there was a lack of case definition, that, it was poorly characterized how many weeks after the index infection and people continue to have symptoms. And so if you look at like the overall studies, we're thinking that 1 in 10 children are actually likely to have long COVID. But let's define that as symptoms greater than 12 weeks and symptoms where the child is feeling impaired to do their daily activities or their play as normal.
Okay, so one of the things, obviously we have characterized and distributed this vaccine based on age, right? So initially it was for elders, and then we opened it up to all folks, and now, we're looking at the 5 to 11. But we had several parents, so we'll listen to three calls here back to back, several parents who wanted to think about size of children at the same time that we were thinking about age of children. Let's take a listen.
My name is Ashley. I'm from Arinda, California.
This is Jennifer from East Hampton, New York.
My name is Catherine Hammer, and I'm calling from Tampa, Florida. My 5-year-old is on the small end of the growth charts. Will that impact the safety and or efficacy of the vaccine?
I have a daughter, age 11, and she is about 5'5" and a normal adult weight. So will the dosage be adjusted to her height and weight?
Why it is safe to give the vaccine to my 5-year-old who only weighs 40 pounds, the same dose as an 11-year-old who might weigh a lot more?
All really good questions. How should we understand that size and age together?
Great question. So as parents, we are all about the dosing of Tylenol and ibuprofen and the age of the weight of our child. And we do that because those medications have active ingredients and they are dependent on how much the amount of available active ingredient is dependent on how much you weigh. Vaccines are different. So with vaccines, what you're trying to do is expose the body to an inoculum that will mount an immune response. And so the truth is that your immune response, or how your immune system responds to a virus, is dependent on your age. And children between ages 5 to 11 have a really robust immune system. So the great thing was that a smaller amount of inoculum was required to mount the same response as we had in adults, but we also found it was safer. So the question about the dose of the vaccine was about safety, not about how much is effective, given that we're doing a lower dose.
That's so helpful. Okay, we know a lot of parents are going to need a little convincing when it comes to vaccinating their kids. Let's listen to this call from Jonathan.
Our daughter's 8 years old, and we were wondering why she should get the COVID-19 shot, since only less than 700 children have died from coronavirus since the pandemic started, out of the 73 million children that are in this country who are under 18.
So, for parents who are saying, why take any risk when that seems like a small percentage of kids?
But is it really a small percentage of kids? You know, when I heard those numbers, I was like, whoa, 700 children? Those are 700 avoidable deaths. And that's what the vaccine does, right? It decreases your likelihood of a severe illness, hospitalization, and death. So I think 700 deaths were potentially avoidable when I hear that. The risks, the side effects, feeling a bit icky for a couple of days, maybe a day off school, you know, I would say that those are worth it if it means my child is with me.
So Dr. Hansoti, in part because so much of your work is also in the international arena, we wanted to take this call in part because in China, vaccines have been approved for children under 3. And we wanted to hear from this listener who's wondering about vaccinations for her 3-year-old.
I'm Katie, and I'm from Red Lake Falls, Minnesota. I have a child who's 3 and autistic, and I'd like to know if I could get a prescription for him to get vaccinated since he's at higher risk.
It's a great question. I'm right there with Katie. I have a 4 and a 1-year-old, and I am eager to get my child vaccinated. You know, the data, the studies have been ongoing for at least 3 months. The data is coming in. The data looks good. The challenge is trying to find the safest possible dose for our children, and they are still processing the data for that. So I think we, as parents, we just have to wait.
As part of that push, obviously, for the 5-year-old and up group is about schools. And so let me ask sort of 2 school questions. 1, do you expect schools to go to vaccine mandates at some point? And in this kind of transition, as some children will become vaccinated, others won't, how should we be thinking about masking in school?
So let's talk the first question regarding vaccine mandates. You know, we make it sound like it's a new phenomenon, but it's not. Our children are already required to be extensively vaccinated to go to public schools. And so this is just one more vaccine that's going to be added to that list. And I think it should be coming, and it makes a lot of sense, right? Because we want to protect all the children that attend school to be as safe as possible. Regarding the second question around masks, well, I don't think the question is whether we should have masks when some children are vaccinated or not. The real question is, should we continue with masking regardless of the vaccine status of our children? The reason is that it is well established already that individuals who are vaccinated can, in fact, transmit the virus. They can still have asymptomatic infection. So if you look at the healthcare setting, which obviously is leading in this area, in the healthcare setting, all individuals are still required to wear masks at all times within hospitals. In addition, if you're treating a COVID patient, we still put on our full personal protective equipment, PPE, in order to decrease the chance of us getting infected and or transmitting that to other patients. So what I'd be interested to see as a, you know, as the winter continues, is what happens in schools where mask mandates continue or are dismissed, and whether like masking is going to be a part of our reality, at least for some activities that are in close approximation with other children.
Hmm. Where are we on the flu shot as part of this, you know, again, going into the winter, going inside? How should parents also be thinking about the flu shot? If kids are COVID vaccinated, do they also need their annual flu shot?
Absolutely. So if you haven't had your flu shot already, please go get it right now, because that has been available since September 1st. You know, what has been great is with masking, I think the incidence of flu and the number of flu deaths annually has decreased. But flu is a different beast. Flu evolves and changes every single year. And so, A, you should go get your flu shot. B, we don't know how bad the flu season is going to be this year, but there is some concern because we all were exposed less last year that it may be worse. And then the third is, there is no evidence that if you have the flu shot, you can't have the COVID shot or vice versa. And some individuals have been getting both shots at the same time. Your child goes to the pediatrician's office and normally gets multiple shots. So I think for the sake of the child, you should maybe spread them out. And that way they have a chance to recover if they're feeling icky, but it doesn't change the effectiveness of the vaccines.
Yeah, I was thinking a bit about the booster shot relative to, you know, my 7-year-old who's a little worried about not so much the vaccine, but about the notion of the shot. And I thought, I wonder if I can get my booster when she gets her vaccination and everybody gets a shot at the same time for a little courage. So who is currently eligible to receive boosters?
So there's two populations that are currently eligible. Individuals who have not been able to mount an immune response or immunocompromised. And then the second are individuals who have a very high exposure to COVID-19, such as healthcare workers. I think, you know, when we talk about boosters, we also have to remember this terminology of additional doses. So boosters are administered to individuals who have completed the primary vaccination series. And we think, depending on the type of vaccine, 6 to 8 months post your initial vaccination series, a booster may be beneficial. An additional dose is different. An additional dose is for individuals who have done the initial doses, but were not able to mount an immune response due to medications that they may be on or like a primary health condition, and thus may need additional doses to be able to be adequately vaccinated.
You talked about the possibility of masks just being part of our normal landscape of living. Will boosters be similar? Will we expect to be going to our pharmacies and getting COVID boosters each year in the way that flu shots are available?
I anticipate so. However, I will say that, you know, we have had the Delta variant, but we haven't had a new variant of concern. I'm knocking on wood right now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, COVID is different to flu in the sense that it doesn't evolve as quickly. And so we don't know how frequently boosters would be needed. It depends on how many variants of concerns we have, and if it's going to be an annual thing or every couple of years or only when a new variant emerges. Honestly, we just don't have that data yet.
Dr. Bhakti Hansoti, who is director of the Center for Global Emergency Care and associate professor of emergency medicine at International Health at Johns Hopkins. As always, thank you so much for answering our questions and walking us through what can be challenging terrain.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
I got my potato
on Radiolab,
and I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
and stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small Potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, y'all. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Today is Dia de Muertos, or Day of the Dead, an ancient Mexican cultural event celebrated across Latin America and in the diaspora. It's meant to honor and remember loved ones who have passed on from this life. The painted decorations and other traditions of the day have become more trendy and popular over the last few years. Stores across the country sell Day of the Dead costumes and crafts. Nike even makes a Day of the Dead shoes. And Disney even tried to trademark the name of the holiday ahead of the 2017 release of Coco, an animated film which brought in $800 million at the box office. The popularity and commercial success raises concerns about preserving the core meaning and value of the festival. Juan Aguirre is the executive director of the Mexican arts and cultural organization Mano a Mano. Juan, thank you for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I introduced this segment using the term Dia de Muertos. I know a lot of us grew up with the language Dia de los Muertos. What is accurate, or are they both accurate? Just a little bit on the name itself.
Sure. So the name of the holiday is Dia de Muertos. But in the United States, when people translate the name into English, it becomes Day of the Dead. And then people here translate it back into Spanish, and the becomes lost. And that's why Dia de los Muertos is really an American or something that is used in English language countries.
Yesterday on Halloween, I'm handing out candy, and there was a fair bit of Dia de Muertos inspired costuming. Now, some of it was coming from members of our Latino community here, which is largely a Mexican-American community here in the part of North Carolina where I live. But there were also a lot of folks where I don't think that that was part of their particular ethnic or racial tradition. I can't be certain, but I don't think so. And so I'm wondering a little bit here how we're meant to feel about this. Is it good that more people have an awareness of the holiday, or troubling that there seems to be what could be, I guess, considered appropriation of the holiday?
I think it's both. Some people are not necessarily don't understand or know the history of Day of the Dead, and a lot of people are blending the holidays, Halloween and Day of the Dead, not really understanding the meaning. I think it could be troubling. We see it, for example, when we go to schools, talk to children, sometimes they ask a lot of questions, and a lot of times we sort of have to correct the things that they think about the holiday, but we have to do it in a way that is, you know, very subtle. So in that sense, it could be a little bit troubling. But in the other, it's also interesting that this holiday is really becoming known worldwide and it's becoming very popular. The troubling side on that is that there's a lot of companies and a lot of people interested in making money out of it.
Let's take the money out for a moment and just tell us a little bit about the history. What about of Dia de Muertos? What should folks really know?
Well, it's a day to remember the people who have died, especially your family members, your ancestors. And it's just a day where you think about them, you can talk to them, or you can remember the beautiful things, that the times that you spend with them. It's really a holiday of reflection and remembrance. And I think that's what people should take from it. And everybody around, every culture around the world honors those who have passed away in one way or another. Mexicans may do it a little bit different because we kind of laugh at death by having skulls all over, by, you know, doing some of the decorations we use, having skeletons dancing and things like that. But I think the most important thing that people should know is that it's a holiday to honor and remember those who have passed away.
All right. So what are some of the misconceptions about the festival?
There's a lot. Some that it's a Mexican Halloween, not knowing, obviously, that the holiday, it dates back to probably 3,000 years, even more. Some of the others, there's something very interesting that I see when we celebrate Day of the Dead, and that's how Americans or English speakers and Mexicans relate to the ofrenda that is created. So we, when we do our festival, we have a big offering where people bring pictures, letters, messages, candles. And when I see people of Mexican origin or Mexicans doing it, a lot of them smile or they're happy. They look at the ofrenda and they feel warmth. But when Americans do it, sometimes they cry because for them it's more emotional. And that's a very interesting cultural difference that I see.
Do you think this is about how Americans typically think about and understand death?
Yes. So there's two things. That's one. And the other is that a lot of all the Americans are discovering the holiday. So they're trying to understand the meaning, as opposed to Mexicans where, you know, they grew up with it. And so for them, it's different. For us, Day of the Dead is about happiness and warmth and thinking about great things about our ancestors and family members. But for people who encounter the holiday, sometimes it's like they think of death in a different way. And so for them, sometimes it's sad.
I with the connections to New Orleans, there is, I suspect, you know, in part because of the creolization of the culture that includes Mexican influences, so Mexican indigenous influences, Spanish colonial influences, as French colonial influences, as well as the kind of more, I don't know, think of it as mainstream American. I also think of New Orleanians as thinking about and approaching death in some ways that are quite different and distinct from how we do death rituals in other parts of the country.
Yes, I think everywhere, you know, in different places, people will probably relate different to the holiday. It all has to do with their background and how they grew up.
I'm wondering, in this year, with so much loss of life in the context not only of direct loss to COVID-19, but also these additional deaths, if you expect that maybe Dia de Muertos is also taking on meaning beyond the commercialization, the kind of Coco Disneyfication, simply because people are looking for a way to connect, maybe often with those who they lost, who they didn't have an opportunity to do the rituals of goodbye that you might normally have in a non-pandemic time?
I think it does. I have seen many, many people, and many people talk to me when we do our celebration. And for many people, this time, you know, bringing a picture, lighting a candle, and thinking about their family members is something that helps them for a closure. A lot of people mention the word closure. A lot of people mention the word reconnecting. So I think the holiday opens up the space for people to feel and to say things that normally they would not have that opportunity.
Can you say a few more words simply about the actual practices of the festival on that day? If one wanted to observe Dia de Muertos, what would be some culturally appropriate ways connected to this 3,000-year history to do so?
The holiday is very old, and there has been many changes, influences throughout its history. But I think the core essence of the holiday is still alive, which is really to remember those who have passed away. And one of the best ways to do that is just to set a space, you know, where you would actually make the connection with that person that has passed away. In Mexico, the most important place in the house or the most important space in the house becomes the ofrenda. And I think for many people who are interested in exploring the holiday or learning about it, you know, you don't really need a gigantic ofrenda or altar to remember your loved ones. It could just be something very small, very simple. The idea is really just to have them in your heart and in your mind.
Juan Aguirre is the executive director of the Mexican Arts and Culture Organization, Mano a Mano. Juan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The COVID-19 pandemic magnified financial instability and widened margins of economic inequality in the United States. A recent poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health found that 38% of households across the nation faced serious financial problems in the past few months. A new limited series podcast called Going for Broke from The Nation magazine and the Economic Hardship Reporting Project is taking a look at the challenges that many Americans are facing right now. The series looks at these issues through personal stories of homelessness, job insecurity, and people just trying to pay the rent.
The very first night, I was in shock about being in a homeless shelter, in shock about being homeless. And so I wasn't thinking, what's going to happen to me if I don't get any sleep? The thought of sleep maybe came within a week. And then it started to dawn on me, like, I'm not getting any sleep. I need to sleep. And so that was when the yearning for a good night's sleep started, and it didn't stop for 2 years.
That's journalist Lori Yearwood talking about her experience with being unhoused from the first episode in the series. Here with me now is Ray Suarez, the host of Going for Broke. He's also an author, journalist, and legend around the public radio world. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Ray.
Great to be with you, Melissa.
So in the kind of introductory article for the podcast, you wrote, quote, "Too much of American journalism consists of stories told by wealthy people to middle-class people about poor people." Such a critically important framework. Can you talk about why it's so important to hear firsthand from people who are experiencing these economic insecurities?
Well, some of it just comes from the power dynamic of the way we do journalism. It's pretty secure people who get to tell everyone else's story. And the poorer you are or the poorer you become, the less often you're given the privilege of self-definition and self-explanation. So what we're given, even during a time when a lot of people are experiencing downward mobility or going into the teeth of the pandemic and its economic effects, is a secure person's view of insecurity, rather than someone saying, this is what my life is like and this is what I need you to understand. And we thought that Going for Broke and the way we structured it was a way of, well, you know, we can't change that overnight and change it in the vast, multi-limbed beast of the American media, but we can start pushing in the other direction.
Can you reflect a bit, help us to understand? Certainly, it is just part of kind of how we do the news, but I'm wondering if there's also some presumptions here, presumptions that when people are telling their own story, they don't have like journalistic distance or something, or maybe that those who are experiencing financial and economic insecurity are somehow inherently untrustworthy in terms of getting their story right.
I think that's part of it. I think that's certainly an unspoken part of it. We never get handed an assignment by the assignment desk. Here, go talk to this poor person. We wouldn't be able to accept what they said unless you talk to them. That's sort of in there like cinnamon in the pancake mix. You just, it's in there, but no,
I appreciate that you put cinnamon in your pancake mix. I do as well. I feel there are people who are going to be like, what?
It's an unspoken part of the whole scene without anybody actually having to articulate it, I guess is the way I would explain it to others. There are a lot of unspoken rules covering how we do poverty. Yes, the media is often sympathetic, but at the same time that it's sympathetic, it's often condescending and judgmental. Without saying it, you're saying, look at this person. Why can't they get it together? I see it as a consistent problem in the way the media does poverty, in part because we have an unfortunate inheritance that goes all the way back to the 17th century of finding poverty to be a personal failing rather than something that has to do with systems much bigger than you can control or reply to that have a big say over how you're doing at any given moment. You know, when employment suddenly craters, that's not something you did, but there's a very old part of American reflex that finds that people's troubles must be a commentary on their own virtue, their own willingness to just pick themselves up and dust themselves off. You know, There's a very old literature in this country that locates poverty and locates bad times in personal failings.
So much so, and so much so kind of baked into our understanding of financial insecurity, of economic inequality, that often those who are experiencing that hardship themselves, ourselves, do feel responsible for it, don't often look to the system, and will feel that sense of that kind of, you know, American work ethic, you know, Horatio Alger story of I must have done this, I must be able to fix it on my own.
Which gives a kind of pass to systems that don't work for us and don't help us well enough when we need the help. That willingness, that reflex to look at the self as the locus of this problem lets the system off the hook, I think, when you think not what's the matter with what's going on, but what's the matter with me? And once you do that, you're saying, I'll work this out. When there are parts of this whole thing, whether it's homelessness, whether it's the blithe ignorance of how several million people are going to pay their mortgages and their rent that's been accruing over the last 21 months, we just sort of think, this will take care of itself and people will do what they have to do. Instead of saying, wow, I really was put behind the eight ball here. That shouldn't have happened. People think, wow, I have to fix this.
So, Ray, you are actually at the center of one of these stories, talking about your experience of finding yourself jobless, struggling with financial insecurity. Can you tell us a bit about how you ended up in that space?
As the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and I scoped out what this series would be like, the kind of stories it would tell, who we could enlist to talk about their own lives, the producer said, well, what about you? I had had a long bout with unemployment after my last steady employer, Al Jazeera America, declared bankruptcy, closed up shop, and put, 800 people out of work. I was not prepared for the kind of reception that I got in the marketplace. I began thinking, well, this will work out. I have a long, solid resume, a good track record. I'm not a head case. I'm a decent colleague. I show up to work every day. This is not going to be that hard. After 40 years, there will be somebody who wants me to do something. And in fact, there wasn't anybody who wanted me to do anything. And it was a shock. It took some getting used to. It took a re-engineering of my expectations of what my early 60s were going to be like. And it also set off a kind of rage because the big voices in the culture tell people in the later chapters of their working life, don't retire. Whatever you do, don't retire early. Keep working. Keep saving. Don't take your Social Security check early. Don't tap into your retirement savings early because you're going to live longer and you have to make sure that you're prepared and you don't want to outlive your money. And here I am saying, okay, got it. I'm ready to do all of that. But no one, there was such a shocking level of ageism in the marketplace that after a while, it was just breathtaking. And then on top of that, I was diagnosed with cancer. And then it just feels like the roof is coming in. You think, all right, I struggled and I pushed and I shoved and I had my elbows out the way the folkways of the business ask me to do. And here I am, I get to this point in my life and I can't work. And now work may be the least of my problems. I may be dying. And it was a time of contemplation, a time of stock taking and self-recognition. I think as character building exercises go, I wouldn't recommend it. It is grueling to both be struggling to live and struggling to work. But now that I'm on the other end of it, I think I've learned some pretty good lessons about a lot of things. And as we scoped out this series, even though I am kind of allergic to using capital I in my writing, it's just not something I've done a lot, I figured, all right, I'll listen to this. This suggestion that I make my story part of this series, okay, we'll try it out.
Well, of course, Ray, that capital I isn't so capital in that it is also first person plural. That I is we. For so many of us who can relate to in various parts the story that you just told, but also that even within this podcast series, you are not the only journalist whose story is told. So just to take a little point of that I-we privilege here, talk to us a bit about the economic hardships experienced by journalists and what it says about our industry.
Well, you know, it would seem, I think a lot of members of the audience, the readers, viewers, listeners, if we said, hey, you know, what do you think? Who do you think is making all this stuff? Because it seems like there's tons of stuff. There's 850,000 podcasts. There's new networks all the time. There's new online publications all the time. This must be a golden age for employment in journalism. I mean, it would be natural to make that conclusion, I think. But quite the opposite is true. There are actually fewer people making a full-time living as reporters than there were 20 years ago. And that astonishing fact, as we watch a broad, ceaseless river of content flow out to the sea, is just one small data point in what has been a crisis in journalistic employment, even as more graduates are churned out of more BA programs and master's programs around the country, only to enter a profession that is rethinking what the world of work is like, whether you have one boss or five, whether you are a brand that you manage and cultivate and really just become a hired gun who works a day here and a day there for different employers all the time, or have a consistent gig. The business model for how people get their information has been undergoing drastic, rapid, and crisis-driven change over the last two decades, and the workforce has been part of that. So experienced people, people with shelves and walls full of awards, people who I think have a legitimate reason to believe that there's a place for them in the business, end up scuffling. I'm an active member and have been for a long time of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. And I started to notice during the 00s and into the teens that every year more and more people had no affiliation on their conference badge. You'd go to the annual meeting, see old friends, veteran friends, people who had edited major regional newspapers, people who had been correspondents at big outfits, and there'd be no affiliation on their badge because they were freelance. Suddenly, they were their own company. And I thought that part of my job was to make sure that never happened to me, not realizing that it didn't matter how much experience you had, there was no way to accurately call the future marketplace. There was no way to accurately predict whether you had built enough of a buffer around yourself, enough of a bumper around yourself, so you wouldn't get pulled down in the downdraft as well. It has been a terrible time and a wonderful time because all kinds of fascinating new product has been invented, new ways to get your news, new things to think about, journalism that penetrates the most inaccessible parts of our common life and other parts of the world. So on one level, it is a golden age because more people are doing more phenomenal work in more unexpected ways than ever before because of the technological revolution in the business. And at the same time, it is an ongoing crisis. And it's hard to fully communicate that to an audience, I think.
One last question for you, Obviously, the nation's lawmakers are currently engaged in a lengthy debate over spending around the social safety net, what holes are going to be left, where is that net going to be shored up. In your reporting for this series, how have you been thinking about this aspect of addressing it? Sort of your point about the machine, the processes, the policies. What stands out to you?
Well, there's exultation about the promise of the gig economy. And I read a lot of business journalism that talks about how it makes things better for employers and makes things better for employees. But when we're in the midst of such an enormous shift in the way people make their living, we have to build up a whole new structure around work. As I found in my years of unemployment or semi-employment, a lot of the things that people take for granted, especially later in their work life, or are asked to rely on later in their work life, it's not that they're inaccessible if you're self-employed. It's just all harder. So yes, the Affordable Care Act makes it possible and plausible, finally, for people who are self-employed to have affordable, reliable health insurance. But if you're earning an income that qualifies you for a subsidy and you're self-employed, the operability of that new system is not everything it should be. So I sat with a caseworker on the phone, and they said, well, I think you'll qualify for a subsidy under the Affordable Care Act for the coming year. How much money are you going to make in the coming year? And I said, well, really, because of the kind of work I do, it's impossible for me to know how much money I'm going to make in the coming year. I assume this coming year is going to be much like last year. So why don't you use my my tax return from last year as your template? No, I'm sorry, we can't do that. Do you have any contracts? Do you have any letters from potential employers? Do you have anything that quantifies an amount of money that you're going to get paid in the coming year? I said, well, that's not the way what I do works. It's April. I'll find out in May that I have something for the first 2 weeks in June. And they said, oh, I'm sorry, we can't work with that. Well, that's a system problem. If you can't take advantage of some major advance in how people buy healthcare because of the way you work, then, well, it's not really working for you, is it? If we say that we've done our job by getting an unhoused person a roof over their head for the night, have we really, if the conditions once inside that shelter, once inside that community center, once inside that armory, once inside that auditorium or gym, have we really done our work if those places are chaotic, loud, dangerous, and people can't sleep in them? Because before too long, if you haven't been sleeping, one of the first things you'll figure out is it gets harder and harder to help yourself and stand back up and get your life back in some kind of order if you're unraveling because you haven't had a good night's sleep in 2 weeks. There are all these systems scattered around our feet, and we say, oh, well, good. If I ever need them, they're there. But then when you do need them, when your father, who you have seen very little of through much of your growing up and your adult life, now is at your doorstep saying he needs help because he simply does not understand the language of the emergency unemployment benefits being offered during the pandemic, do you swallow hard and sit down with all the history that you have with this man and help him fill out his unemployment paperwork? Well, yeah, eventually you do, but there should be some sort of answer for a person in that predicament. And one thing that the series Going for Broke illustrates is how we trust in the existence of these systems. We say, well, thank God I don't need it, but if I do, it's there. And then when you do need it, you find out how insufficient to the task it sometimes can be.
Ray Suarez is host of the limited series podcast, Going for Broke, a project of The Nation and the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. He's also an author and journalist of many decades. Ray, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure to talk to you, Melissa. Thanks.
Okay, y'all, let's end this Monday on a high note with another transformational takeaway. Last week, I came across an article that really hit home, and these men surely deserve a shout out. A group of fathers who call themselves Dads on Duty have decided to start walking the hallways of Southwood High School in Shreveport, Louisiana. Before these dads decided to walk the hallways of the school, multiple fights had been breaking out, and in the span of 3 days, 23 students were arrested. So these dads took matters into their own hands, and they decided to help curb the violence and be a liaison for their children. And since they started walking the halls on September 20th, there has not been one violent incident on campus. These men are so worthy of a shout out on this program. Good job, papas, for showing us how just your presence can be transformative. We here at The Takeaway, we see you. If you think of anyone making a difference in your community or in any community, call us and let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or email us a voice memo at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back. Let's talk again tomorrow.